Welcome to Attached, a platform for adding breadth and depth to everyday living. I'm Yaakov Danishevsky, and this is the conversation series focused on my book. In each episode, I invite a special guest to discuss the topic of a particular chapter and how it relates to our lives. Welcome to another Conversations episode. We are looking today at chapter 8 of the book, titled Is God Too Perfect? And I am really excited to have this conversation today with Rabbi Dr. Joshua Golding, who is somebody that I have actually, back when I was studying more academic philosophy, I read some articles from and remembered that name for a long time. And then when I was in LA recently, I had the chance of meeting your son and reconnected. And he pointed me to this amazing book that you wrote. So anybody who's interested can easily find a lot of information about Dr. Golding and his work as a professor of philosophy and philosophy of religion and Jewish philosophy and the rabbi of a congregation for many years. And your son pointed me to this book called The Conversation, which I found really fascinating. And there was an excerpt in it that, or a passage in it that I wanted to bring up to start a conversation as it relates to what I wrote about in my book in chapter 8. So to quickly summarize my chapter and then to quickly summarize the topic of your book before turning to you. So the chapter that I wrote about is titled Is God Too Perfect? Because the premise of what I try to share in this book is the idea of a very personal relationship with God. And the question that I get so frequently from people so often when I talk about that is, well, if God is so perfect, if God is so transcendent and so beyond us, how do we really have a personal relationship with him? And so in the book, what I explore is one approach, one response to that question, certainly not the only one. And I think that what you're going to offer is hopefully different, similar, you know, maybe related, but different than what I shared. What I talk about is ways in which God actually chooses, so to speak, to come down from that transcendence while somehow still maintaining that transcendence. So God chooses to be more personal, chooses to actually lean in, so to speak, into vulnerabilities. And God is described as having, as laughing or crying or needing assistance, etc. And so this all-powerful being actually chooses to put on the garb of, in some ways, having weaknesses so that we can become interpersonal related. So that's what I discuss in my book. And then I was reading your book called The Conversation, which for anybody listening, I really recommend this book. It's really, I haven't finished the whole thing yet, but it's so interesting. It's a novel, but it's kind of like a philosophical novel. It's a modern day version of the Kuzari, in which there's a secular Jewish kid who's going to college and has a variety of different friends and professors and rabbis on campus who his kind of spiritual and philosophical instincts and intuitions and searching brings him into conversation with all these different people. And through that, he kind of explores Western culture, Eastern culture, different forms of Judaism, different strands within Jewish thought. And the novel brings out all these different philosophies. And there's one passage here where he's talking with a rabbi in the book who came to give a guest lecture. And I want to read this passage and then ask you to elaborate on it. What it says here is this rabbi is writing an email to the main character in the story named David Goldstein, great Jewish name. And so the rabbi, Rabbi Lowe, writes this, the following email. Dear Mr. Goldstein, first, some pleasantries and just, you know, beginning of an email. And then he says the following. There's a very big difference between the Jewish conception of God and the Eastern conception of ultimate reality. Judaism conceives of God as a person, that is, as a he. To say that God is a person doesn't mean God has a body, but rather that God has a will and that he is rational. God makes choices. He plans. He creates. He communicates. He commands, and so on. And since God is a person, Judaism teaches that if we take the necessary steps, we can have an interpersonal relationship with God that involves mutual love and respect. The necessary steps, according to Judaism, include following the way of God, following his commandments, respecting him and loving him, that is, keeping the Torah. On the other hand, generally speaking, for the Eastern religions, the ultimate reality is not understood as personal. Taoism is case in point. The Tao is conceived as the ultimate structure or way in which the universe operates. The Tao is not a he, but rather an it. The it doesn't speak, doesn't communicate, it doesn't love us, and it certainly doesn't issue any commands. Most importantly, you can't have an interpersonal relationship with an it.
Yes. So we'd like me to like elaborate on that point of distinction.
Yeah, if you could.
I mean, I first, I really should say that there's some, you know, oversimplification there, especially about the Eastern religion. I mean, Eastern religions are so various, and I'm not really a technical scholar in Eastern religion, but it's a certain, there is something definitely out there, and I think Taoism is a good example of that kind of conception. I think it's not very different in certain ways from the so-called philosopher's god that is spoken about in Western culture, the Aristotelian concept of God that, you know, the Rambam, Maimonides, spent a lot of time distancing himself from in a way. Of course, though, of course, Maimonides was very influenced by the Rambam, but in particular, the notion that you can have an interpersonal relationship. The notion of God as having free choice. The Rambam is, I think, one of the clearest. The Ramchal also, Moshe Chaim Tzatzo, they're very clear on the fact that God has free choice and human beings have free choice. You know, we often see in those philosophies where the ultimate being really doesn't have free choice, the same thing really is true in the end for humans. We don't really have free choice either. And, you know, the Rambam is very big on how important it is for the fact that humans have free choice. Without free choice, Torah and mitzvahs, he says, doesn't make any sense. Responsibility doesn't make any sense. You can't hold people responsible for either doing good deeds or bad deeds unless they have the ability to make a choice between doing good deeds and bad deeds. So I think the key idea is free choice, or sometimes philosophers use the word agency. An agent in this sense is an entity or a being of some sort that has reason, rationality, because you can't have free choice unless you also have reason. Because to have free choice means you need to be able to deliberate and think and evaluate between options, right? So you need to be rational in order to be an agent. But there's something else. It's some kind of a power or freedom to act in accord with what you have chosen. I think that's central to Judaism. And it's very different from what you find in many Eastern philosophies or religions, if we call them that. And also in classical Western philosophy, you know, going back to Plato's theory of the good, the ultimate being of all beings, it kind of emanates from itself. It's a causal source. For Aristotle, God is ultimately rational, but really doesn't have free will. Okay, so you have reason, but you don't necessarily have free will. You're automatically doing what is rationally fixed, and you're basically expressing your own necessary being in a necessary way, if that makes sense. I think that Judaism, classical Judaism, the Rambam, again, he's my primary example of, you know, someone who writes about these issues explicitly, believes that, yes, God is eternal and necessary. There's something necessary about God's being. There is something fixed and eternal, and there are certain things about God that are unchangeable. And even God himself, I mean, here you get into a little bit of controversy because, you know, there's questions about what are the limits of God's freedom. Maimonides, Rambam says that there are certain things God can't do. For example, God cannot kill himself. God cannot destroy his own being because his own being is necessary. And even if you say he could do it, but he just chooses not to, then you're violating the notion that his existence is truly necessary. So this is the paradox in a way. I don't think it's a logical contradiction. There's a difference between something that's paradoxical as something that's logically contradictory. I think Judaism holds that God is necessary and perfect as he is, but at the same time, God has free choice. He has the ability to act, and he can choose to create the world. He can also choose not to create the world, for example, right? I mean, that's one of the big choices God apparently has made, right? That he did choose to create the world, but the world, according to the Rambam, according to, I think, most classic Jewish philosophers, the world is not a necessary thing. It's a free choice. And God chooses to communicate. God chooses to punish, to reward. God chooses to guide his people. God chooses to do lots of things, right? And that is absolutely essential to Judaism.
I'm curious, do you have thoughts on there's a lot of draw and interest, I think, in some of the Eastern ideas and philosophies, particularly Buddhism, that's taking hold for people who are more spiritually inclined, let's say. A lot of Israelis, after they finish the army, they take a trip, to explore kind of Eastern spirituality. A lot of Jews have moved towards, what they call the Jubu movement, so many Jews going towards Buddhism. I'm curious what your sense is in terms of what that's about, why that's happening, and what is this idea of the personal God that Judaism is offering, coming to counter or offer differently than that.
Well, I mean that phenomenon has been going on for, quite some time. I think people say in the 60s, whatever, I don't know. I was born in 1961, so I wasn't, exactly part of that culture, but I think that there is a draw to a kind of spirituality that there's very little. It's tempting in a way because there's some kind of spiritual bliss, there's some kind of peace and harmony, and there's some kind of real depth to different forms of Buddhism and different forms of Hinduism, especially I think philosophical Hinduism, which we could talk about if you want to, but the notion that there's an ultimate oneness, that you can in some way feel or come in contact with, that is going to make you feel, give you some kind of deep meaning in your life, to connect with something ultimate. And what's convenient, I guess, about at least certain forms of Buddhism and certain forms of Hinduism, is that there's very little doctrinal trappings. There are the do's and don'ts tend to be basically be a good person, be ethical, be a nice person. Compassion is a very big thing in Buddhism. And a lot of people who maybe they're born Jewish, but if they're raised secularly, or even if they grow up with some, religious background, there's this view that it's a very widespread view. It's been around for a long time, that God doesn't really care whether I eat pork or cow. God only cares about whether I'm a good person, right? So you have in certain forms of Buddhism, certain forms of Hinduism, and Taoism also. It's very a lot of these Eastern religions preach a kind of calmness and peace, and basically be a good person, but it takes you beyond mere secular humanism. Okay, it's something richer and deeper that takes you to a connection with something that's ultimate and transcendent, which in secular humanism, you don't have that. There's no God, there's no transcendent, that's all baloney. Do you know what I mean? That's so it gives them something rich and powerful. But it doesn't involve the trappings, or shall I say, the obligations that you find, let's say, in something like traditional Judaism. You have to keep Shabbos, you have to keep kosher, you have to do this, you have taras mishpacha. A lot of people coming from that background are they don't believe in that, or they're skeptical about it, and this gives them a spiritual path of some depth, without those obligations. I myself, when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I was very drawn to. I mean, I grew up Orthodox, and my father, Olav Shalom, was a philosopher, so I grew up with philosophy in the home. But I also found myself as a teenager, drawn to those Eastern forms of spirituality. I, would do yoga, and I got into meditation a little bit. So I think there's all that, that does. I mean, this, I think that answers the question to some degree.
For sure.
Just
And
being an ethical person is great, but there's something the soul, I think, cries out for that transcends just, being a nice human being. That's great, but that's can be part of a bigger spiritual life that involves some kind of relationship with the ultimate being, i.e., God, or whatever you want to call it, the one, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
So where does in your mind, where does the Jewish view or approach what is it coming to show differently
Okay,
in that
so
posture?
I mean, speaking about myself, this is sort of autobiographical, but I think this is a valid point generally that I sort of came to think that what, when you look at, and I think this is in the conversation, this is kind of laid out a little bit over there, is that I think that Judaism offers everything that is offered by those other religions, but it takes it even greater. It's an even further step. Because I think that ultimately a person of some sort is a better being than a non-person. I mean, you could have a very, very wonderful it that's, infinite and transcendent and one, but if it's also on top of that, has agency and free will and is able to choose and interact in some way similar to the way a human being that chooses to act or interact, choosing freely with responsibility. To me, that is a greater being than a being that's as good as it is, it's still an it. I think that as you write about in your book, for example, the most important thing people you say pay lip service to this, but it pay lip service to this, but I think it's true that for most people, the most important thing in their life is relationships with persons, right? I mean, you can have a relationship with a thing, with a car, with money, even with pleasure. You can have a great relationship with art and music. But I think that there's something very special about human beings. What's special about them is their agency, the fact that they have free choice and responsibility, and they're able to be moral agents and do things that are worthy of praise or worthy of blame. And I think that a God who has that, and on top of that is also transcendent and perfect in certain ways, I mean, we can talk a little bit more about that, is a better being. I'd rather relate to that being well than I would relate to a mere it, even if it's a very infinite, very powerful it, it's still an it.
And then where do the commandments and the obligations that come with that, as opposed to what you were describing before, fit in?
Well, I mean, I think that, like you say in your book, that and you said earlier in your quotation from my little from the little snippet from the conversation is that God has done us, according to Judaism, God has done us a great favor of instructing us. I mean, there are certain things that we intuitively know are right or wrong. I believe that at a certain level, humans n should know, should realize that murdering an innocent person for no reason or just for fun or just because you don't like them is wrong. I do believe that we have a certain innate moral sense about basic things that are, that's it's not right to torture a cat just for fun. Things like that, you know what I mean? But Judaism says that, well, yes, those are that's true, but God is that God is the ultimate person of all persons, and to have a interpersonal relationship with God is, whoa, I mean, that's, wow, that's pretty amazing if that can happen. That's what Judaism teaches. And Judaism comes along and says, not only has God revealed himself to a few prophets here and there and given them some random instructions, but God has given us the Torah, which is an expression of himself, which is, it's filled with mitzvos, with do's and don'ts. It's also filled with, teachings about midos and teachings about, qualities of personality that we're supposed to have. People make a mistake to think that it's all just about, the external do's and don'ts. And like you say in your book, that, we can often fall into that as Orthodox Jews, just going through the motions. And, but, the Torah is filled, as Rabbi Yochanan, what is it? Rabbi Chanan ben Akasha, Amar Rav Tzadok Baruch Hu, Lezakus Yisrael Levichach, Hirbu Lehem Torah Mitzvos, right? He gave us many things to do, many things not to do, midos to cultivate. There's learning, there's meditation. If you take it to the level of Kabbalah and Hasidus, there's, deeper levels of knowledge and understanding of God's ways. And if you follow that path, and of course it's not supposed to be just something an individual does, but it's a collective thing. Am Yisrael, Klal Yisrael, is supposed to be something we do not just for ourselves but for the world. Then that all of those things that we do following the Torah is that's the roadmap that God has given us to achieve that relationship with Him and to bring His project to fruition, tikkun olam, bringing about the redemption of the world. It's not just about having a relationship with God, it's about fulfilling God's projects. I think you mentioned in your book, relationships, of course, and I think one of the things that if you love someone, you want to help them realize their projects. You want to support them, and you want to do what you can to foster their projects. Now, of course, if it's a child, if it's a spouse, if it's a friend, if it's a stranger, it's going to be different. If it's God, then part of loving God and serving God is doing those things to help God fulfill the project that He chose to employ when He created the world, the goal, the telos, as it were, of the world that God. That motivated God to create the world in the first place, anyway, maybe I'm going off your
Not at
question.
all. That's a really beautiful way of thinking about it also, that the idea of, because I always kind of thought of those two things as being kind of separate approach, distinct approaches
Which two things?
within Judaism, the two things being either relating to mitzvos and relating to Judaism as a way of creating relationship with Hashem, kind of direct, like panim el panim, kind of right, face to face, like that, versus a distinct approach from that being that we are kind of here to achieve something for God. And I kind of thought of that not so much as panim el panim, but almost more like kind of business partners, right? We're like, God's here and I'm here, and like we're aiming towards the same thing. But I kind of framed those in my mind always as two separate ways of relating to Torah and mitzvos. And what you're describing is that there's actually a very beautiful way of integrating those
I
two,
see.
which is when I'm in a relationship with somebody that I love and care about, part of that relationship is that I want to help encourage and be a part of any way that I can of them achieving and accomplishing what their projects and goals are. And so those two things really kind of come together in a really nice way. I'm curious, you mentioned before we could talk more about, what it means for God to be perfect. And I'm curious to hear about that. And then also in the context of the different, let's say, psukim or verses and Ma'amari Chazal statements in our texts and tradition about just that seem to describe God in ways that seem very human, which is in line with what you've been talking about. So I'm curious to hear more about that.
So I would say this. I think I'm going to try to lay out three options and tell you which option I think is the best one, in my opinion. But maybe different thinkers, different people will, be more attracted to one or the other option. One option is to say, look, the the God of Torah and the God of the Talmud, the Medrash, is just not, it's not the same thing as the God of the philosophers. It's a mistake to try to, there are Jewish philosophers who advocate this view, that, in Greek philosophy, they talked about how, God is perfect and complete and everlasting, okay, but one approach is to say you can't reconcile it. In other words, God is finite. The God of the Torah is, I'm not saying I endorse this. In fact, I don't like this view, but I'm saying it is out there. It is a possibility. One could go with this and hold that the God of the Torah just is not the same thing as this infinitely infallible, perfect being who never makes mistakes, who can't even make mistakes. That's it's just you can't marry the two. God is fallible. God makes mistakes. He messes up. He does this. He does that. Okay, that's one possible view. I don't agree with it. I don't think it's the prevailing view in classic Jewish and even rabbinic thought. Okay, now going to the other extreme, there's another extreme, which is to say that all of those statements in the Torah and in the Midrash where there's some implication that somehow God is fallible, it's all really a fake. It's a fake for a reason. In other words, because for God is totally perfect, never make mistakes. Has no emotions, no feelings, doesn't really cry. He doesn't, that's all basically like, for children or for people, sort of first learning about Judaism or because that's the only way that, it's like a clever ruse that the Torah and the rabbis invented, because really it's all about us. In other words, God is perfect and he doesn't really need us, but he's a nice guy. So he created a world in which we have the ability to perfect ourselves. And again, all of those statements in the Torah regarding his being upset, his being angry, he's regretting, those are all really at the deepest level false. And it's just like I said, a clever ruse to help us, better ourselves somehow. Okay, so that's the other extreme. The view that I would support, and I think this is really the Rambam's view, is that you have to make a very careful distinction between the essence of God. Okay, there's God's essence, which is perfectly one and perfect as an essence. It is the perfect essence. Okay, it doesn't have any parts. It's perfectly complete in and of itself. But yet at the same time, this perfect essence that is necessary has free choice. We talked about this a little while ago. And God has free choice, and God chooses to create a world which he wants to be the best it can be. Now, as the Ramchal explains, I think this is in Derech Hashem, where he talks about this at the beginning, more or less. He explains why God, chose to create a world in which there's free agents, because the good that God can create is without people deserving it or earning it, it's not going to be as good as a good which God creates, which people then earn or deserve or merit. Okay, I think this is something that's very, very intuitive. The things that you work for and deserve and earn become part of you in a way that those things that just come to you, like let's say a Yerusha or whatever it is, good looks that you were just born with, the things that you earn and merit by your hard work are the best things that you can have in life. And therefore, when God creates the world, he chooses freely to create mankind. And the plan is that hopefully man will freely choose to engage in a relationship with God, to do good actions, to be kind and generous and compassionate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And to seek out a relationship with him because he's the best thing that there is to relate to. And so God, to some extent, we're saying that yes, God does sort of roll the dice. because he creates people with free will, and then it's up to them to choose. Now, the thing is, God can always intervene when necessary. Free choice can be limited or can be restricted or can be taken away, like we see with Paro, for example. If God chooses to, he can say, okay, enough, right? So we believe, I think it's a fundamental teaching of Judaism that, yes, we have free will and we have choice, but God is not going to let us like really go down to the point where we're beyond redemption. He can always intervene, but that means our free will is going to be diminished somewhat. Okay, so how does this relate to the issue of, this the psukim that you mentioned, is that God's plans can be frustrated because we have free will, right? So if man chooses to do wrong, or let's say the Bnei Yisrael, to do chait ha'egel, or the chait in the Midbar with the meraglim, whatever the sin is, they're choosing to do things that is not leading, is not, helping the plan to come to fruition. So that's when God gets upset. He gets angry, he gets upset, he cries because but he's not he's first of all, obviously he's not physically crying because he doesn't have a body, we believe, right? But they're mishalim, they're as the Rambam says, Dibra Torah Kolashim Be'adam, right? That it's as if God is crying because his plans are being frustrated because this is the way he chose to do things, right? To create people with free will who can then mess up and not, do what they should be doing. So, I mean, in a sense, you could argue that, oh, well, then you're saying that God really isn't perfect because, he created this world and things aren't always going the way he wants them to. Well, yeah, that's true, but he chose, like you said, it's a choice that God made to create a world in which there are free agents because that's a better deal than just creating robots who always do what's good. It's a better deal for us, and it's a more of a full expression of his nature. I think to take this to a deeper level, this might, go beyond the time that we would have to spend on this is I believe, and I try to articulate this in the conversation a little bit, like later on in the book, is that God's free choices is they are contingent expressions of the necessary. In other words, for example, try to give you a quick example is we believe that God is one, right? But God, he's necessarily one. God chooses to create a world which ultimately is going to express in a contingent way, contingent meaning could have not been the case, but in a contingent way, the world is going to express God's unity. Aftos, the oneness that we all, look forward to during the time of Mashiach, when man is united and human beings are getting along and there's a harmony and a peace in the world, that's going to be an expression of the one true God who essentially is one. But now it's expressed in a contingent world. So I think that, God is, there's a reason for why God chooses to create the world. It's an expression of himself. He could have chosen not to, but it makes sense that he did, even though he wasn't necessitated to. There's a little bit of a tricky thing going on there. But so again, just to summarize this view is that he things don't have, there are certain things that God wants to happen that don't happen because we mess up and that makes God upset. But his essence still remains perfect. It's just the expression of that essence is not coming to fruition as quickly and as smoothly as God would want. And of course we believe, our tradition teaches us that one day it will happen because God will make sure that sooner or later there will be that perfect world that we will live in. But he wants us to do what we can do to make it happen on our own as much as possible.
Yeah, it's really helpful to hear the kind of the spectrum. Obviously, there's more and more nuance or detail, but a basic
Sure.
framing of the spectrum of that, of the two extremes, and then how this kind of fits into that, into the middle there, and really it's really helpful. Thank you. I'm curious to pivot a little bit,
Sure.
although possibly connected to, probably connected. One of the things that's come up is meditation, and the other thing that's come up is philosophy. So I know that you are a philosopher. as well as in some of your other books. I don't know if it's in the conversation, but you talk about meditation practices, spiritual meditation practices. Stereotypically speaking, and obviously stereotypes are not always accurate, but stereotypically speaking, professors of philosophy in academic institutions are not the people that we think of as being people talking about or practicing meditation. And I'm curious for you how those two things kind of go together and what it means to you that you engage so much in both.
Well, like you said, it's a stereotypical thing to think that academic philosophers don't engage in meditation. I mean, if you go back to, some of the great philosophers of the past, and again, I mean, if you go back to Lao Tzu, I mean, maybe he probably wouldn't fit in so well to certain academic departments of philosophy these days. You might find them more likely in a department of spirituality or a department of theology. But first of all, I think that there are many, many great philosophers. I mean, if you look at the Rambam, even, he's often considered to be like the super rationalist. But if you look at the Rambam toward the end of Mor Nevuchim, and you can even find this a little bit in Mishneh Torah here and there. He talks about contemplation and how important it is to just sort of focus and contemplate on God and on the oneness of God, and just meditate, contemplate. Maybe if we use the word contemplation, that has a different ring than meditation. But I don't know, if you look at Ramchal, you look at the Kabbalistic tradition. Although I am, yes, a professor of philosophy, I am an Orthodox Jew, and that already you don't find many in today's world. You don't find too many. Well, actually, you don't find too many Orthodox Jews in academia in general, especially in the humanities. I don't know. There's a lot of. It seems to be a lot more secular oriented. But I'm drifting a little bit. Let me get back to my point, is that I'm not just an academic philosopher. I'm also an Orthodox Jew. I consider myself to be, I'm not from a Hasidic background, but I'm very, very interested, and I've spent a lot of time learning Sifrei Hasidus, and I'm very, very interested in Kabbalah. And there, meditation, his bodhidus, his bonenus, whatever you want to call it, is a very, very important part of that tradition. And I am a philosopher, but I also I'm a religious Jew. I'm trying to be devout, and that's meditation is very much a part of Judaism and of all the great religious. If I Christianity, whatever. The Eastern religions, Islam, there's the Sufi, there in every great religious tradition, there is there's there you're always going to find mystics or those who engage in some form of deep meditation as a way of connecting with the ultimate. And I mean, for me, over the last few years, I'd say, I davening, tefillah is a kind of meditation. It's not silent meditation, but tefillah and preparing yourself for tefillah is, they talk about how Hasidim HaRishonim used to spend an hour just like shehiyah, which is a whole big topic, but what that means, just preparing themselves to daven, and then an hour after davening. So it's very much a part of the Jewish religious tradition, although I think it's been a little bit of a lost art, especially in modern Orthodox and maybe even, ultra Orthodox circles. You daven, but davening is important, but contemplating and meditating, it's unfortunately, I think, been to some degree swept under the rug somehow. Maybe there's reasons for why. But yeah, I mean, I am a professional philosopher, but I'm also an Orthodox Jew, and trying to make the most of my religious life as possible, and meditation is definitely a piece in there.
So I'm curious, meditation, in its popularity now in, let's say, Western culture, is more in the context of calming down, dealing with stress, anxiety, the stresses of life, etc. You're talking about it more, it sounds like, in a way of connecting with, as you said, the ultimate path of God.
I think that all the things you just mentioned are part of it. I mean, sort of focusing on what's really important, focusing on, closing your eyes and just focusing on what is truly important, eternal, realizing that things that are going on in your life or things that are going on in the news, which can be very disturbing and distressing, opening that window to a peace that is eternal and everlasting. And Shabbos, for example, it's taught that Shabbos is a symbol of the next world. Shabbos is a great day for meditation, by the way, right? You have time, you're more relaxed, you're not working, you don't have the phone, you don't have the TV, you don't have the car, you don't have the computer, right? Shabbos is a great time. So, we talk about the Mincha of Shabbos afternoon as a time of Rava Deravin, a time when we can sort of somehow tap into that the future state where the world will be in a place of tikkun and all evil will be banished and suffering will disappear. I mean, I think it includes some of those elements that you mentioned, but it takes it further. It takes it to an even deeper level. It's not just about, okay, I need to have some time out, so I'm not thinking about my job or the news, but it's connecting with something. It's doing that as well as connecting with, the ultimate being who is running the show and who is a person and not just an it, and is going to wipe away all the tears of mankind.
And I guess that really maybe kind of brings us full circle in closing, because what you're saying now is really parallel to what you were saying before about how Judaism at large is includes so many of the things that people are drawn to, let's say, in those Eastern traditions, in terms of that yes, we care about being a good person, but then we want that to have more meaning and more richness, and so people are looking for that spirituality, that equanimity, the connecting to something broader, to the oneness of the world. And what you're saying is, so there's kind of the baseline is like there's the secular humanism of being a good person. Let's say, what this is obviously an oversimplification, but then that gets included in something more meaningful when we move into bringing Eastern traditions into it. And then what you're saying is Judaism really has all of that as well, but then also adds the God as a person, so to speak, which allows us to connect to an even deeper and more enriching sense of meaning and purpose.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
Dr. Golden, thank you so much
Are you
for
up?
making the time to speak with me, for taking a look at the book. And I found this conversation very, very enriching. For anyone interested, the book that we were referencing is one of a number of books that Dr. Golden has written, but this book is called The Conversation, and highly recommended for continuing or exploring these topics further. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a great honor and pleasure to be part of your podcast. And again, the book is wonderful, and I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it and getting back to you with more questions.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using Yaakov, Yakov, .attached@gmail.com, or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.